ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
You're listening to The Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Hello, Selena Green again here to deliver The Country Hour to you, fresh to your door today. In a moment, well, how common is it for dairy companies to have to break up their payments back to dairy farmers? And when they do, what does it say about the state of the industry? I'll take a look at that in a moment. And what could Australian agriculture look like in the year 2050?
So the more desirable scenarios involve things like transformative technologies, higher productivity, environmental restoration, whereas those less desirable scenarios involve things like declining yields and productivity, more extreme climate change and weather events, and biodiversity loss.
What do you want it to look like? Let me know on my talkback number, 1300 222 891. The text line, 0467 922 891. The year 2050. It's a bit closer. You may think it'll be here before we know it. Well, yesterday we heard from Beston's Global Food Company, which has blamed challenging conditions in the dairy industry for its decision to split payments to milk suppliers this month. Farmers' payments from the company will be staggered, 85% of what they're owed initially and the remaining 15% by the end of April. How common is this sort of thing and what does it say about the state of dairy? Robert Brokenshire is president of the South Australian Dairy Farmers Association. Thanks for coming on the program.
Thank you, Selena. Nice to talk to you again.
We heard from Beston's yesterday explaining their split payments that they're doing to their suppliers this month. How rare is that within the industry to have a company have to resort to that sort of measure of paying its farmers?
Yeah, well, fortunately, it is rare and unusual. At the moment, there's mixed signals right across the world when it comes to not only dairy, but also other agricultural commodities. So it's a tight international market, and I think they've been held up with some payments that are due to them from overseas wholesalers. But it is, generally speaking, rare, and SADA, as the Dairy Farmers Association for our farmers, obviously want our farmers paid on time and in full.
Would this be putting some farmers under pressure having to wait for their second round of payments?
Yes, it is going to put some farmers under pressure, and I've discussed that with Beston's, but, you know, Beston's are doing what they can to make sure their business is as strong and sustainable as possible, and obviously whatever business you're in, most are fairly highly geared, and, you know, that's no different with our dairy farmers. So if they've got cash flow plans for their budget for that month, then obviously if they don't get all their money straight away, that does make it tough for them. But having said that, the mid and long-term future for dairy from every report I've read looks good, but I'm hoping for the whole world's economy and for Australia's that we see a turnaround in inflationary problems that we've seen, and also interest rates coming down and people being able to spend a bit more money on essential food right across the world.
So for some context, I guess in the short term and the situation that the industry is facing at the moment, what sort of put it in a position where, you know, you've got companies and international buyers having pretty tight belts at the moment and struggling to make payments on time?
Yeah, well, that's not a good signal, that's for sure, but what's happening, China, that were buying and buying and buying dairy and other product, they've pulled right back. And, you know, I saw the Federal Treasurer projecting only 4% growth there for the next 3 years, which is the lowest growth in China since nearly 50 years. So that obviously gives you an indication of just how tight it is post-COVID. And what we're also seeing as a result of that is that New Zealand and America in particular, where they were doing very well and selling a lot of product into China, now don't have that market. So we've seen, you know, certainly an increase in the amount of dairy products being brought into Australia from both New Zealand and America. And my message would be, Selena, that, you know, please buy Australian product for a long, sustainable and secure and fair price dairy commodity sector. We need consumers in Australia to, wherever possible, be buying dairy that's actually produced in Australia, and that will help us in the short term because we need our domestic market as strong as we can. The demand's certainly there, but even domestically, it's pretty clear that people are pulling their belts in as well.
Mm. You say, though, the longer or the more mid and longer term outlook, hopefully some good news on the horizon there?
Yeah, that's what I'm hoping. And, you know, there's some pretty substantial reports that have been done. I mean, one of the things that we're seeing right at the moment is that a lot of the medical science reports around the world are showing the importance for all age groups, but particularly younger people and older people, that they should have three serves of dairy a day. The nutrition and the value and the protein in that for the price that you pay is still the most affordable, and people are indicating that they want to increase their consumption. And in fact, demand's been pretty good in a lot of areas, and there's growth in Asia. So we're hoping as Asia becomes a stronger and stronger economy that they will buy more and more Australian dairy product as well, because they know they're buying the best dairy product in the world, and also we're close to their market. So longer term and mid-term looks pretty good, but right at the moment the world's pretty fickle, and that's probably the best summary I can give you. It's not only households and farmers and businesses in Australia that are finding it tougher than it has been for some time. It's an international problem, but there are little rays of sunshine coming through, Selena, and, you know, we're starting to hear talk internationally and in Australia that interest rates will start to come down this year, and if people aren't paying so much in interest, then they've got more disposable income for food, and, you know, dairy's a real staple, so that hopefully we'll see some growth and turnaround there in the second half of this year.
Speaking of things that can be fickle, the weather certainly can. I imagine there would be quite a few looking for a good autumn break, and well, traditionally we'd be getting that sometime in the next week around Anzac Day.
Well, that's what we'd love. We've got the Premier coming to our farm next week to launch the 24 to 29 Dairy Action Plan, and I hope he brings some rain when he comes just before Anzac Day, because even on the Fleurieu Peninsula, it's very dry. Our board members reporting to us from the southeast are saying that it's dry. And look, farmers need an opening sooner rather than later. Some of the forecasters are saying it's going to be a late start. Let's hope it's not too late.
Rob Brokenshire, thanks for joining us today.
Yep. Thank you, Selena.
That is SADA President Rob Brokenshire. And if you missed the interview with Best in Global Foods yesterday, you can listen back to that. It's on the ABC Listen app. Look for South Australian Country Hour or go to the South Australian Country Hour website. It is 13 minutes past 12.
You're listening to Selena Green on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Well, it's no surprise that accurate weather readings are key for farming decision making, and farmers in the state southeast now have an extra weather stat at their disposal. Yesterday, the state government announced a $2.35 million investment in the 43 weather stations operated by Mesonet. Josh Bryan spoke with the Minister for Primary Industries, Claire Scriven, about what this investment will do for farmers in the region.
This is a $2.35 million investment into Mesonet stations across the southeast, a total of 43 stations, which is really important for farmers when they're looking at spraying to help to reduce spray drift. It's about really high quality information that they can access on their phones based on the stations that are now spread across the Limestone Coast. And that means that they can know when it is safe to spray, when it's not safe to spray. And that's good not only for them in terms of making sure they're getting the best use of the chemicals and they're not wasting it, but also to ensure that we're not having spray drift affecting other crops and other parts of the farming community.
Has the state government been involved in promoting that expansion?
So the state government's investment has been for the infrastructure for the Mesonet. That's really important, and it's followed on from investments in other parts of the state. But in terms of the subscription, I'm advised that's currently free for farmers. So that's a really good opportunity for them to get to know how to use it and what the benefits are. And then down the track, they'll be able to have a more formalised subscription process.
So what sort of producers does this sort of system benefit?
So it really benefits anyone who's planting crops, who is affected by inversions, the hazardous inversions. I was explaining to you what that is all meaning today, in terms of making sure that when it's safe to spray, that's when the chemicals can be applied, and when it's not, they don't. I mean, it sounds very simple, but to be able to actually make informed decisions about that, there's a lot of data that's needed, and that's what the Mesonet is providing.
Yeah, a little bit about that hazardous inversions. I guess what sort of conditions do farmers, I guess, not want when they're trying to spray and things like that?
Yeah, it's really interesting to see the weather stations, because we often think of weather stations to do with temperature, but this is not about just about temperature. It's about a whole lot of other data. So it's in terms of the wind speeds, the temperature, the other aspects that all go into whether it's going to be safe to spray and whether it's going to be appropriate to spray on any given day. So, you know, a lot of information which is all put into one, which can then give the farmers the information that they need. And we know, you know, there's a lot of people who are concerned about spray drift. Sometimes it's the vineyards, sometimes it's other adjacent properties. And so making sure that we reduce that is really important in terms of social licence for continuing to use sprays, and really important also for farmers to make sure they're not wasting their money by losing half of their spray if they're doing it under the wrong conditions.
I guess these sort of smart systems or Internet of Things and things like that seems to be very in vogue at the moment. Is that something the state government's interested in supporting more of to help farmers get more of that data available to them?
Yeah, well, we've certainly been supporting a lot of agricultural technology. We have the demonstration farm at Struan, of course, which is really important in terms of being able to not just demonstrate but get farmers there to be able to see how it works in local conditions, which is really important. And they can ask the questions. And, of course, part of those initiatives is around, you know, that extension work in terms of giving that information, whether it's at field days, whether it's other events. So it is really important, and it's something that the government has been supporting.
You were out on a property today. What did the person there say to you, the farmer say to you, in terms of the usefulness of this sort of technology?
Yeah, they said that it was very, very useful, and they really appreciated the fact that the government was supporting the investment in the infrastructure, and then that means that they're not trying to cough up the money to be able to install this sort of thing themselves. As an individual farmer, it probably really wouldn't be feasible. So that was really good, but also to have the extra data to know that they can then spray with confidence was really important. And so I think they saw it as a big step forward.
So you've mentioned that this technology is currently free for farmers to sign up to, but it will become a paid subscription in the future. Is that something that the state government might consider either subsidising or helping to fund?
Well, the way we've approached it elsewhere in the state is that the government has assisted with the infrastructure in terms of the ongoing subscription. The company that provides this has provided it free of charge for a period of time to be able to, I guess, demonstrate the benefits to farmers. And then the farmer will need to decide whether to continue it. But certainly the ones I was speaking today to, as well as others that I've spoken to in other parts of the state, have said it's actually invaluable, because even if you're just looking at the cost side of it, the amount of money that's saved by making sure that the spray is being applied at the right time in the right place and not being lost to the wind is actually a really important consideration. And we know that the input costs for farms have been increasing, and certainly chemicals are not immune from that by any means. So there's an economic argument to it, as well as the social licence argument and the general argument about being responsible to make sure that chemicals are not going off target onto other crops.
That's the Minister for Primary Industries and Regional Development, Claire Scriven, speaking with Josh Bryan. Well, have you ever wondered what Australian ag might look like in 2050? Well, it's a question that key stakeholders are asking and wondering how we're going to adapt to a changing industry. A scenarios report has been released looking at the future of ag and the key challenges. CSIRO Futures Agriculture and Food Leader Dr. Catherine Wynne spoke to Lily McCure about the report's findings and how Australian agriculture can learn from the analysis.
Our report presents an evidence-based picture of what farming systems could look like in 2050. So this work combines research by CSIRO and input from leaders across the Australian agricultural industry, research and government sectors, including input from over 100 participants. And with these participants, we co-developed four plausible future scenarios, ranging from two more desirable scenarios through to two more less desirable scenarios and what that might mean for the future.
Why was it important to sort of collate this data and produce a report like this?
Yeah, so we developed the report because we see a need and an opportunity to create a long-term vision of what farming businesses and communities might look like so that the agricultural industry can plan for it. So globally, much of the innovation in agriculture is focused on things like indoor, intensified or urban farming. And these approaches don't really address the unique Australian context, particularly around broadacre and extensive landscape farming. So we think Australia can play a leading role in informing the rapid transformation of this system. And so we wanted to work with a lot of stakeholders across Australia to co-design this series of plausible future scenarios for what Australian farming systems might look like in 2050.
What does Australian agriculture look like in 2050?
Well, so as I said, we've been thinking about, you know, four different plausible scenarios. We had many different scenarios and we had to sort of try and put it together into four, or just choose four. And as I said, they range from, two more sort of desirable scenarios to two less desirable scenarios. So the more desirable scenarios involve things like transformative technologies, higher productivity, environmental restoration, whereas those less desirable scenarios involve things like declining yields and productivity, more extreme climate change and weather events, and biodiversity loss. So we tried to think of all these different sort of plausible scenarios, and we're very interested in the types of signposts that might tell us that we're on one path towards one of those scenarios, or also thinking about the types of trade-offs that we might need to make between those different futures.
And I guess those less desirable prospects for Australian ag, I guess, what's that going to mean for people in the industry, and how might we sort of overcome that?
Yeah, so the least desirable but plausible scenario we consider is system decline, and that's, you know, where we've really reached a tipping point, where we've got delayed and fragmented decision-making that leaves farmers facing, you know, those sort of economic and environmental consequences of climate change and things like that. In terms of what needs to happen, how we respond to those trends and challenges over the next 20 years really determines the future. And we really have a great opportunity here where we can avoid those less desirable scenarios by putting in a lot of effort and action. And through our discussions with all these stakeholders, we've identified five key shifts that Australia needs to make to pursue that more positive future. And those shifts include things like action around climate adaptation, looking at how we use our land and water, industry development, workforce, regional growth, and then also how we adapt our agriculture research and development system to be as effective and innovative as we can make it.
That is the CSIRO's Futures Agriculture and Food Lead, Dr. Catherine Wynne, speaking there with Lily McCure. It is 22 past 12 on the Country Hour today, on this Thursday, with Selena Green. Let's go to today's market report. That's the Mount Compass report, and Elsie Adamo has it for us today. Hi, Elsie.
Good afternoon, Selena. More plain cattle were on offer and numbers increased substantially as agents offered 1,100 live weight and open auction cattle, with 500 steers, 346 heifers and 211 cows making up the bulk of the numbers. The best of the cattle in most categories sold at firm rates, however secondary cattle eased markedly as the sale progressed. The usual trade and process of buyers were in attendance and operating along with feeders and restocker orderers. Prices generally reflected the quality on offer, with some wide variations throughout the sale. Veala steers ranged from 180 to 301 cents, as veala heifers sold from 120 to 300 cents per kilogram. Yearling steers sold from 160 to 305 cents, with yearling heifers selling from 80 cents to 303 cents per kilogram. Manufacturing steers sold from 100 to 273 cents, as grown steers ranged from 225 to 297 cents, as grown heifers sold from 180 to 279 cents per kilogram. Light cows ranged from 50 to 141 cents, medium cows sold from 100 to 241 cents, as heavy cows ranged from 60 to 273 cents per kilogram, bulls sold from 120 to 235 cents per kilogram. This has been Elsie Adamo filling in for John Traeger for the MLA's National Livestock Reporting Service.
Thank you, Elsie Adamo, yes, with today's report. All right, it's time to head to the Weather Bureau today. It is Simon Timke is our forecaster. Hello, Simon.
Hi, Selena.
What's going on out there weather-wise?
Well, quite a bit of cloud about southern districts today, and the feature producing that is a cold front approaching from the southwest. That front will move across sort of, well, we really just catch the tail end of it across southern coastal districts later today and early on Friday. And that will bring a little bit of showery activity with it. Looking on the radar at the moment, there's some showers about the lower southeast district and the eastern end of Kangaroo Island. And I think today the showers will mostly be confined to the southern southern coastal districts, but there could be the odd light shower that pushes a little bit further north over the southern agricultural area. But further north will be dry, and we're seeing clear skies right across the pastoral districts and Flinders district, and even most of the west coast district is in sunshine at the moment. We did have a little bit of fog and very low cloud about western parts of the west coast district earlier this morning. Tomorrow morning, as that front moves across, we'll see those showers extend a little bit further inland. So isolated showers possible about the agricultural area. They'll be more frequent about the southern agricultural area and in particular about windward coasts and ranges. And I think late this evening and early tomorrow morning will be when they're most frequent, and we'll see those showers gradually clear through Monday afternoon. So by Monday evening, the showers will have completely cleared from South Australia. And then over the weekend, that high pressure system currently centred south of Western Australia, that will move across the south of our state to be centred over the Tasman on Monday. So that will give us dry conditions right across the weekend and plenty of sunshine too. So Saturday will be dry and mostly sunny. Even with that sunshine, I think we'll still see maximum temperatures a bit below average, but it will be a bit of a cold morning, Saturday morning. Cold mornings continuing on Sunday and Monday as well, with minimum temperatures well below average, I think, in some parts on those two mornings. But we will see warmer conditions during the day. I think maximum temperatures sort of near average on Sunday and above average on Monday as we see the winds turn around a little bit more northeasterly as that high gets out over the Tasman. So a slow warming trend over the weekend and Monday, but certainly some cold places during the early mornings. Through the middle part of next week, it does look like we'll see another cold front move across. But like this one, it doesn't look to be producing a lot of showers. I think for Tuesday, we'll see those showers develop a little bit later in the day, mostly confined to the southern agricultural area and mostly about sort of southern coasts and ranges, with a similar sort of pattern through Wednesday and Thursday. But the four-day rainfall totals are not looking too much. And I think out of the next 4 days, out to the end of Monday, most of the rainfall that we see will occur later today and during Friday, with those dry and mostly sunny conditions expected for Saturday, Sunday and Monday. So the rainfall totals, I think, for that four-day period out to the end of Monday will generally be less than 2 millimetres, but I think there are a couple of spots where it will be a little bit wetter. We might see some falls of 2 to 5 millimetres, and I think that's likely about the lower southeast district and remaining windward coasts and ranges. So the sort of southern coast of Kangaroo Island, the southern and eastern slopes of the Mount Lofty Ranges, and then the eastern coasts of York Peninsula and Eyre Peninsula are likely to see some of those slightly higher rainfall totals, I think, Selena. Mm. But generally speaking, not a lot of rainfall over the next couple of days.
No, it doesn't sound like it. And certainly some cold starts to brace ourselves for.
Yeah, so over the weekend and Monday, I think we will see some fairly cold mornings, and then not quite so cold through the middle part of next week with that next front pushing across. But that front, like this one, unlikely to bring too much in the way of rainfall, unfortunately.
Mm. All right, thanks for that, Simon.
Thanks, Selena.
Simon Timke there from the Weather Bureau. Looking at the western inland of New South Wales, for tomorrow, the upper western district, a partly cloudy day with southerly winds 15 to 20 k's an hour, becoming light early in the morning, and then southerlies 20 to 30 k's an hour throughout the morning. Overnight, down to between 9 and 12 degrees in the day, the low to mid-20s. For the lower western district, cloudy, slight chance of a shower in the south, near zero chance elsewhere. Southwesterly winds 15 to 25 k's an hour, turning southerly 25 to 35 k's. k's an hour in the morning, dropping back to around 15 to 20 k's an hour in the evening. Overnight, between 8 and 11 degrees. During the day, should reach the low 20s. It's coming up to 12:30 here on the Country Hour. I've heard a lot about this supermarket inquiry. Will it actually achieve any change? We'll talk about that in this next half an hour.
You're listening to The Country Hour. For more stories from across the country, go to abc.net.au/rural. On ABC Radio Adelaide, South Australia and Broken Hill, this is Selena Green. Selena Green.
Good afternoon. Are you getting your five a day? Well, I'll be honest. Well, the Heart Foundation says for good health, we should all be trying to eat at least five serves of vegetables and two serves of fruit every day. Well, maybe you might try your best. Might always get there. For some reason, Australians are eating less vegetables while farmers are growing more of them. Are you someone struggling to get enough fruit and veg in your diet? And if so, why? I'm keen to know, is it access? Is it cost? What is it? Let me know on my talkback number today, 1300 222 891, or the text line 0467 922 891. I'll cover this a bit more shortly. And have you ever been to a clearing sale hunting for a bargain? Well, one of Australia's oldest companies has recently trialled its first online farm clearing sale here in South Australia. But does it mean the days of kicking tyres and scrounging for a bargain at these events, are they over?
Touch and feel is great, and there's still always going to be the clearing sale that gathers the community together, gets people out, gets them socialising, gets them talking. Not only is it a great way to socialise, it's a great way to promote yourselves and sell goods and chattels and plant machinery.
That's coming up before 1 o'clock as well. But right now, here is Matt Coleman with your news update. Hello, Matt.
Hello, Selena. In the news this afternoon, the chair of the South Australian Parole Board says that Snowtown Murders accomplice Mark Ray Hayden is being slowly reintroduced to living in the community while residing at a pre-release centre. Hayden was released from prison to the centre a fortnight ago after the Attorney General, the Police Minister and the Commissioner for Victims' Rights decided not to ask for a review of the decision to give him parole. The 65-year-old served almost 25 years in prison for assisting the Snowtown killers in covering up and hiding the bodies of seven of the victims, including that of his wife, Elizabeth Hayden. An Adelaide man who brutally murdered his housemate and placed his body in a wheelie bin has been sentenced to at least 26 years in jail. Daniel Gordon Bremner was found guilty of murder after a jury trial in February. The Supreme Court heard the deceased was a frail man who suffered from health conditions, whom the accused had met on Tynley Street in 2021. And South Australia's unemployment rate rose to 3.9% in March. It was up 0.6 of a percentage point on last month. That's slightly higher than the national average of 3.8%, but remains lower than the rate in Victoria and Queensland. More news at 1 o'clock.
Thank you, Matt. Matt Coleman with your headlines. Well, it's been a big week for the Senate inquiry into supermarket prices, with Bunnings, Coles and Woolworths all copping a grilling. And there were plenty of fiery moments, such as this one from Greens Senator Nick McKim.
You're here before a Senate committee today. We're not interested in PR spin. We're not interested in you kind of bullshitting your way through this committee. We are interested in you answering the questions.
Well, beyond all the bluster, will this inquiry actually achieve anything? Well, Matt Brand spoke with Julian Burnett from the National Farmers Federation and asked for his thoughts on what's been learnt throughout this week.
I think we've learnt that the consumers and the suppliers' concerns are well-founded. I think to see representatives of the three big boxes duck and weave and evade really has confirmed in everyone's mind that they're participating in behaviour towards their suppliers and their customers that they're not particularly proud of.
Do you think this inquiry will actually achieve anything and lead to anything meaningful?
It is something that certainly concerns the members of the Horticulture Council. This wouldn't be the first public inquiry where there's been a lot of sound and fury, but it's ended up signifying very little. So we are concerned. But look, I think it's worth saying that the level of public scrutiny on the big boxes, on the supermarkets, I think there are six separate inquiries of various kinds looking into this, and the interest the public has shown and the airing that it's got in the media, I think will mean that CEOs and their boards think a lot more carefully before participating in this sort of unconscionable behaviour and before, you know, they so blatantly attempt to price gouge. So I do think it will see a tempering of behaviour at the very least. Now, obviously, we hope for far more than that. We hope that...
Yeah, what would the National Farmers Federation ideally like to see?
Yeah, we'd like to see, there's a thing called the Food and Grocery Code, which is at the moment voluntary, but it sort of stipulates the sort of behaviour there should be between suppliers to these big supermarkets and Bunnings and those companies. At the moment, it's voluntary. We would like to see it made mandatory, and we were very pleased to see Dr. Emerson's interim report recommend that. We'd like to see the ACCC given much increased investigative powers to be able to demand information from the big supermarkets and Bunnings, to be able to determine clearly whether they are price gouging, what sort of margins they are charging. You know, one of the hidden costs here is they may, at a headline level, pay growers market price for their produce. But then by the time the growers paid the rebate for promotion, the rebate for shelf space, the rebate for store improvements, the rebate for early payment, growers are often getting much less than the original contract price. So we'd like to see the ACCC have powers to expose those kinds of behaviours and the details of the contracts, not necessarily to the public, we understand commercial sensitivities, but at least so that they can be assured this sort of behaviour is not taking place. We'd like to see much increased penalties. And again, we were very pleased to see Dr. Emerson recommend in his interim report penalties of up to 10% of turnover. Now, you know, God forbid that those sorts of penalties ever need to be used, but it is really important that the regulators have those sorts of penalties that are commercially significant to companies of this size in their back pocket to try and to improve their behaviour.
So, just on the Food and Grocery Code of Conduct, I heard Bunnings argue that the code's sort of designed for supermarkets and is not fit for purpose for a retailer like Bunnings. What do you think?
Oh, look, we think it should undoubtedly be applied to Bunnings. We do accept that there may be some modifications, some alterations required. Yeah, I would accept Bunnings' point that there are some differences, but not sufficient to warrant not including them in the code. Their behaviour is so similar to the behaviour of Coles and Woolworths that it's very clear they need to be regulated under a similar framework.
And just finally, I think we've all learnt a bit about return on equity in the last 24 hours or so. Do you think it's an accepted measure of a company's profitability?
Oh, look, absolutely. I mean, I acknowledge that Woolworths board and their shareholders are entitled to use whatever measure of their profitability they see fit. However, they would be calculating their return on equity, and clearly Coles' ability to give that figure to the inquiry shows that the companies do measure that. And it's also a legitimate measure of profitability. And Woolworths' reluctance to divulge it, I think Senator McKim and the inquiry were right to be suspicious of that. You know, when their return on equity makes them more profitable than the most profitable banks in the world, while consumers and growers are having to tighten their belt, I think that really tells the whole story.
As the chair of the National Farmers Federation's Horticulture Council, Julian Burnett, and he was speaking there with Matt Brand. It's 21 minutes to one. Well, multinational company Accolade Wines has put an offer to growers that supply grapes through CCW Cooperative to sell their red wine contracts for $4,000 a hectare, as all in a bid to rebalance the wine glut. Hundreds of growers that we've heard attended meetings earlier this week to learn about the proposal. It would also see the company cut the volume of grapes it accepts by about 20%. Now, Accolade needs two-thirds of voters to agree to this offer at the CCW AGM, which is next month. And it needs that to happen for it to go ahead. With grape growers being paid historically low prices for their fruit, the company is hoping the offer will entice those wanting to exit the industry. Accolade Wines Chief Supply Chain Officer Joe Russo explains what this offer is based on.
So Riverland Wine, who are an industry body up here, have produced a policy document which has gone to government, which has recommended 3,000 hectares actually of vine removal at $4,000 a hectare. So it's commensurate with that proposal and policy document as scripted by Riverland Wine. We've also engaged closely with CCW from December last year and actually met with the growers on the 14th of February for the first time, listened very, very carefully to the feedback and responded accordingly with regards to if there are growers who want to make a conscious choice and exit the industry, they can do so with dignity. So hence the financial incentives associated.
What sort of response has Accolade Wines heard from growers so far?
It's been mixed. So we've had, there's clearly some discussions around pricing of red grape varietals in the region, and whether the number is good enough to entice people to exit the industry. That's been some of the feedback we've had through the sessions. Unfortunately, market pricing is market pricing, and you know, Accolade certainly doesn't set market pricing. It is a function of global economic environments. We all know that there's a surplus globally in red wine, so it's been mixed feedback to date, but certainly looking forward to receiving more feedback from our grower community over the next couple of weeks prior to the nomination for the AGM.
And the meeting so far, you said there's another one tonight, but have there been many in attendance?
I would say roughly 50% of the grower community that was invited to attend each of the sessions have shown up to each of the sessions.
So how important is a proposal like this then for the future of Accolade Wines?
Yeah, look, it's incredibly important because it's going to provide certainty, and it's really the only offer on the table. We're working really hard to win support because the alternative is significant ongoing uncertainty for both of us, both Accolade and its CCW cooperative and the grower base. And we can't forget that the existing agreement in its current form is 25 years old. It's really not fit for purpose for the highly competitive and volatile international market that the Australian industry is facing. So for me, it's incredibly important to get structural balance back.
So, Joe, could you paint me a scenario if two-thirds of the growers agree to this? What do the next steps look like, and what might, you know, the sort of next few years look like?
The terms associated with the proposal come to fruition, so we'll guarantee 150,000 tonne or 93% of the CCW cooperative universe in volume terms. We'll have really good, strong pricing mechanisms, which are fair and reasonable and underpinned by weighted district averages. And we continue to build a strong relationship and partnership with CCW Co-op and its grower base.
So the alternative, if the number of growers needed for this offer, you know, if there's not two-thirds of growers that accept the offer, what's next and what could things look like?
Well, it's really hard for me to predict and or speculate on what that looks like. I'm in charge of managing our supply chain, and in reality, what's next is probably something that's not inside my control. My focus is on really building an understanding of this proposal and trying to sanction as much support as we can possibly get. So unfortunately, I can't speculate on other potential outcomes.
And just to clarify, so Riverland Wine were talking about needing to remove 13% of the region's vine. How many hectares is Accolade proposing? And they're not saying to pull out, but how many hectares is Accolade proposing to buy out in this agreement?
Yeah, 1,217 hectares, Eliza.
And how was that figure arrived at?
So it's 1,000 hectares, which are CCW PSA growers, which is the equivalent of 23,000 tonnes on average of red varietals, which balances up our red portfolio. And there's 217 hectares of the direct grower contracts, which we will hopefully provide levy relief for the entire CCW grower universe, which is the equivalent of 5,000 tonnes of red varietals.
Accolade Wines Chief Supply Chain Officer Joe Russo. State Liberal member for Chafee, Tim Whetstone, says growers need to approach any decision with caution.
Accolade has now made an offer to buy contracts, but I think if the CCW growers are going to vote on this offer, they must have all of the information in front of them. I urge them to make sure that they've got all the facts before they make a decision to vote and whether they accept the offer from Accolade or whether they need to amend the offer, to making sure that we actually have a viable proposition here to help the industry, not just a proposition that will help the winery and leave the wine grape growers stranded on a rock.
That is the State Liberal member for Chafee, Tim Whetstone, ending that story from Eliza Berlage with additional reporting from Timu King. CCW Cooperatives Chair and General Manager were contacted for comment, but they declined at this time. It is 15 minutes to one.
Hi, Cyber Elaine here. Here's a news flash. Not all the news is negative. Seriously. There are stories of progress, hope, and how individuals and groups are making the world and our communities a better place. And those stories can be inspiring. You can hear some of those ideas on the ABC's new podcast, The Bright Side. Search for The Bright Side podcast in the ABC Listen app.
This is ABC Radio Adelaide, South Australia and Broken Hill.
Selena Green with you for The Country Hour today. Now, do you get your veggies in? Is it five a day at least that we should be getting? Well, a new world vegetable trade map, which was released by Rabobank, suggests that while global production is up, Aussie consumption of veggies is actually down. Analyst for Rabobank, Pia Piggott, says, or told Elsie Adamo, that the takeaways from the new report.
So we've been looking at the trend in vegetable trade over the past 5 years, and globally, it is growing. It's reached, it's surpassed $100 billion US dollars worth of trade in 2021. So we are seeing quite significant increases in trade, and that's really due to increased costs and increased prices as well. So we've seen extreme weather events, skyrocketing costs for growers and challenging logistics, and that they're just some of the factors that have impacted the sector.
Right, so that means that more vegetables are travelling internationally than ever before?
Yeah, definitely. We're seeing that particularly large producing countries like the EU and the US, they've actually seen declines in their production and quite significant increases in their imports. So major import exports of vegetable countries like Mexico and China is another major producer and exporter. We've definitely seen trending away from, in some of these bigger countries, producing less and importing more.
And is that producing less across the board, or are there particular types of vegetables that these countries can't grow themselves at the moment?
Yeah, so it's all different in, vegetables, it encompasses lots of different products and specific categories. So it is quite different across the board, but we're seeing quite significant increases in exports of things such as tomatoes and onions and those more general specific vegetables.
And so within all this, how does Australia compare?
Yeah, so Australia is relatively quite a small exporter of vegetables. We export about $250 million worth of vegetables in 2023, and we produced about $5.8 billion worth of vegetables. So most vegetables in Australia are consumed in the domestic market. And what we've seen over the past 5 years is that there has been some changes in availability of vegetables, particularly things like tomatoes. So tomatoes are one of the most, on a per capita basis, one of the most available vegetables for consumers in Australia. And we eat about 8 kilos per person in Australia, but that's come down about quite a long way from 10 kilos in 2017. So we have seen some changes in the availability of those more common vegetables such as tomatoes, onions and carrots, but we're seeing growth in leafy salad vegetables. So that's an interesting trend on the consumer front.
And a bit of a trend as well towards higher quality vegetables as well.
Yeah, definitely. We're seeing that consumer interest is really going towards more higher value vegetables. And instead of purchasing greater volumes and focusing on things such as carrots and pumpkins, more higher volume, that we're going towards those more increased value, such as those leafy salad vegetables, cauliflower, sweet potatoes are also trending higher, as well as also, yeah, including those categories. Like in tomatoes, there's lots of different varieties of tomatoes, so trending towards those snacking tomatoes instead of just your regular tomatoes.
And Australian produce, obviously, of high quality. How do organic vegetables fit in with all this?
Yeah, so Australia is does produce a lot of organic vegetables. About 5% of our vegetable production is organic, and we see much higher rates of organic production in countries such as in the EU, like Denmark and Austria. They have very high rates of organic production. So compared to Australia, still Australia has quite relatively small percentage of organic production.
So what are kind of all these stats saying with the overall story with vegetables in Australia then? We're just not eating them quite as much as we used to.
Yeah, so the ABS also recently released some data on consumption, which also confirmed that, yeah, vegetable consumption in Australia is slightly down. And, yeah, we're definitely seeing that the impact of higher prices, the impact of the overall inflationary environment and cost of living pressures are impacting vegetable consumption.
That is Rabobank analyst Pia Piggott there speaking with Elsie Adamo. It is 10 minutes to one. Well, online clearing sales and livestock sales certainly aren't a new thing, but their popularity certainly ramped up during and post-COVID. Well, this year, for the first time in its 185-year history, Elders has conducted a statewide online clearing sale. It was trialled in South Australia as a new way of selling plant and machinery for the company. So why now? Well, Laren Gogol is the State Livestock Sales Manager for Southern South Australia for Elders, and I asked him if this was a new way of doing things for a very old company.
Yeah, correct, Selena. Like, we're 185 years young this year, and we're a very traditional but modern company, which sounds a bit conflicting and controversial, but, yeah, we've been doing clearing sales traditionally on property for that long. It's not funny. The new electronic medium selling on platforms is probably something that's evolving. And for us to get involved and do it on a statewide basis was probably a little bit unique because most things are done regionally rather than state-based.
So this particular sale, just give us an idea, it was a combination of branches from around the state pulling together items?
Correct. It was opened up to Elders South Australia and through to Broken Hill, Mildura, and all our South Australian-based branches, of which 20 branches basically gathered items, which stretched from branches of Woodner right down to Mount Gambier.
And what kind of interest did you have? Did you get many sales through that method?
Oh, look, it was a very good method to get it out to the general public and release it out into probably an area that gave us an opportunity to just get interstate looks as well, knowing that we were trying to get a lot of items that consisted from big ticket items down to just general sundry type plant. So all in all, I think it was something like 28,000 views of the items that were catalogued, which was enormous, to end up with just shy of 3,000 people that actually participated in the auction, either as just genuine guests or as active bidders, which I think there was about 1,500 people that were genuine active bidders on it.
And how does that sort of compare to an average clearing sale where people have got to actually walk through the gate?
Well, I don't think we've ever registered that many people for a sale. We've had big sales where we've, you know, registered 400 to 500 people to bid and buy on the day, be competitors on the day. But to have, you know, over 1,400, just shy of 1,500 people actually competing in a sale certainly outstrips what would have happened physically on property.
And you mentioned that you had some large items, so there was some, you know, large-scale machinery listed as part of this sale?
Yeah. We went from headers down to old farm Fords and Major tractors. We had feeders, we had silos, fencing material. It was a bit open. It looked very much like what you would see if you walked into an on-property physical auction of any clearing sale, with just what was there bar the the nuts and bolts and washers that we generally sell at the first part of any clearing sale. So, yeah, from what would have been probably $600,000-$700,000 header down to that $645 a collector's item, farm, forwards and major.
Why is now, you reckon, why is now the time the Elders was keen to get into doing sales this way?
I think there's a lot of gear on farm that people have accumulated over a long period of time, and through periods they've sort of graded up and bought the new piece of plant or the new feeders, new bins, and the other ones have just stayed there waiting for an opportunity of a clearing sale. And certainly by not having to pick it up and take it anywhere has been very well received. COVID, God bless it, has taught us many things, and it's probably taught us to be a little bit social, media-centric and using electronic platforms to view things and operate and buy things. So all accumulated with wants and needs, and we decided that we would try something, as I said, rather than just regionally across the state, knowing that there's people everywhere that have got things to sell and people everywhere that want to buy plant and machinery.
Is this the way of the future? Will there still be room for traditional clearing sales for people who want to come through the gate and kick the tyres and pick things up and you know, do the old shake it and touch it?
Absolutely. Touch and feel is great. And, you know, there's still always going to be the clearing sale that gathers the community together, gets people out, gets them socialising, gets them talking. Not only is it a great way to socialise, it's a great way to promote yourselves and sell goods and chattels and plant machinery. So that's not going to be superseded. But we do realise that those people that sell properties or have plant reduction sales are certainly still going to be about, and they're probably best suited on farm, maybe interface with an electronic platform, which we've done as well. But for those guys that have got a tractor and a truck and the biggest piece of gear we had, as I said, was a header, but that was a complete dispersal for a farmer on the York Peninsula that had over 60 items that he wanted to sell as a major plant reduction. So it suited him to do that in his environment. So there's always going to be the opportunity to utilise both mediums.
Yeah, and that's for clearing sales. Is it sort of the same case for livestock sales as well, that bit of both worlds will be the future?
Yeah, a bit of both worlds on the livestock front has been there for a very long time. You know, Options Plus, which was originally CALM, was probably the instigator of electronic marketing of livestock, and that's been going for a lot of years now, and it's a good electronic sale yard base. We're always going to need sale yards of some descriptions, and electronic and physical ones are a way of the world now, and that's going to continue. And, you know, Options Plus to us was probably a grand opportunity to capitalise with them, with their unique base, and spread across the nation to do something like we did with this online clearing sale.
Yeah. You know, because if things have been up and down, it very much depends on what you're farming at the moment. That interest that you've had in this sale, Aaron, does that say to you that there's still plenty of people out there, you know, looking to buy and perhaps get themselves a bit of a bargain?
I wouldn't say a bit of a bargain. I think people are realists about what is the value of things. Yes, we always like to shop and shop well. I think in recent times it's been very difficult, and you've been on a waiting list for machinery and goods. So when things come up online or at clearing sales or in any particular sale that you can actually get your head around and get hold of very quickly, it probably takes you away from that waiting list. So there's always going to be the people out there that need, like I said before, there's wants and needs and there's opportunists, and we love them all, and we need them to be a part of the environment we work in.
That's Laren Gogol there. He is the State Livestock Sales Manager for Elders for Southern South Australia. It's just going on 2 minutes to one. Nikolai Balhartz will be with you for Afternoons again today. Hello.
Hello. If you were listening to the program at the start of the week, you may have heard of the great snail mail race that we initiated. This was to do with the changes that Australia Post announced, that letters would only be delivered every second day, and it was going to take a little bit longer for them to be delivered. Well, in very exciting news, I have three letters in my hand.
Wow.
That were all on my desk this morning. And I actually got a little kick out of, even though I knew that they were coming, I was like, oh, letters, that's nice.
Well, yeah, because the only thing you get in the letterbox these days, let's be honest, is bills.
Yeah, exactly.
Or junk mail.
So our regional colleagues have been sending these letters to us. So I don't know, I haven't opened them yet, so I don't know who are the joint winners of where they came from the fastest. So we'll unveil that this afternoon.
An enveloping, no?
Yeah,
is that
un-enveloping?
No?
Yeah.
I just made a new word.
Yeah,
congratulations.
Yeah. We'll be talking language as well this afternoon. You'll be very pleased to know. Yeah, so we'll get into that world too.
Oh, you're brave.
I know. It's folly for a radio presenter.
It really is.
We'll see how we go.
Oh, you'll be getting more mail.
Yes,
you'll be getting hate mail about your pronunciation.
Probably.
Let's hope not. Nikolai, have a great show. Nikolai Bailharts, he'll be with you this afternoon for the afternoon's program. Thanks for your company today. You can catch up on anything you've missed on the South Australian Country Hour on the ABC Listen app on our website. I'll be back tomorrow at noon for more. It's news time now.
To get started with the ABC Listen app, find the App Store on your phone. Search for ABC Listen, tap the pink ABC Listen icon and download it. Congratulations, now you've got ABC Radio in your pocket.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.